Music Festival is September 25th and 26th. Listen to local and regional musicians playing on the historic porches in the hamlet of Calicoon on the banks of the Delaware River. Find the lineup and more information at CalicoonPorchFest.com and on Facebook, Instagram, and the Porch Fest playlist on Spotify. Calicoon Porch Fest, live music September 25th and 26th. Paid for by I Love Calicoon, Inc.
Welcome to the local edition, local news and information, keeping you connected in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Jason Dole. And coming up on tonight's program, we continue our series of conversations with the community. Marking Hispanic Heritage Month, we'll be checking in with Juanita Sarmiento, who we've had on the program before. It'll be good to hear from her again. From Rural Migrant Ministries, Juanita will be checking in. Whenever you talk to Juanita, it's a good opportunity also to check in about labor issues in the area. That conversation is coming up in the second half of the program. But first, if you are filling your car up with gas, you know the drill. You open the fuel door on your car, lift the nozzle, press that button for regular premium. Eventually, though, most New Yorkers may be adapting to a different routine. That's because earlier this month, Governor Hochul signed a bill that will end the sale of gas-powered cars in New York by 2035, shifting the state towards electric vehicles and other alternative fuels. To tell us more, Radio Catskill's own Patricio Rubio spoke with Heather Brown, Sustainability Coordinator for the Sullivan County Sustainable Energy Office. And he starts off by asking Heather to give us an overview of this bill and how it affects us.
Well, it's a very small bill, but it's a very loaded bill. And I should first say that this bill itself is setting the goals for the state. It does not actually contain the regulations as far as how we will get there, but it sets the goals for the state. And this is a basic rundown of what those goals are. By 2035, 100% of all passenger cars and trucks offered for lease or sale for registration in the state of New York will be zero emission vehicles. And when we say zero emission vehicles, obviously we're talking about electric vehicles, possibly hydrogen fuel cell powered vehicles. And, you know, this is 14 years out, so whatever other exciting technologies kind of come out in that time. So that's kind of the first goal. The second goal is that by 2045, 100% of medium duty and heavy duty vehicles offered for sale or lease in New York State will also be zero emission vehicles. The bill does also address off-road vehicles to the maximum extent that it's feasible, and those vehicles have a goal of also being zero emission by 2035. So those are that's the timeline of the targets that the legislation addresses. The legislation does go on to address a couple of other items, such as directing the State Department of Environmental Conservation, who will be responsible for the implementation of this law, to work with state agencies and other partners to develop regulations to increase the volume of zero-emission vehicles on the roads gradually, as well as to develop other items such as market development, infrastructure development, and promotion of other non-vehicular transportation options such as bike lanes. So there's a lot that's going on in just about a page and a half of legislation here.
Wow, you know, it sounds like a lot. And like I said, these are the goals you said, and we still have the whole other work that has to be done. The state has all that work that has been done with the regulations, I'm sure.
Yes, it's an incredible amount of work. And I know, you know, 2035 can seem like quite a distance away. But realistically, 2022 is just around the corner. So we're talking about 13 years to implement a very robust program here to meet these goals.
This bill follows legislation from 2019 that calls for the state to reach 70% renewable energy by 2030. How does this new bill fit into the state's other initiatives?
Well, this new bill is actually kind of an offshoot of what was in 2019, the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act was signed into law by then Governor Cuomo. That act, in addition to several really ambitious renewable energy goals, sets the ultimate goal that by 2050, New York State will have an 85% reduction in emissions, for greenhouse gas emissions, and economy-wide, carbon neutrality. So what that basically means is that we're going to reduce emissions by 85%, and we're going to address the remaining 15% with things that are called carbon offsets, such as planting trees or carbon sequestering initiatives. So that's a very ambitious goal as well, obviously. And the reason that this new piece of legislation is so important in meeting those goals is that the transportation sector in New York State is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. Its portion of greenhouse gas emissions is about 29% of total emissions in New York State. So without aggressive action on the transportation sector, it's absolutely impossible to meet any of the goals that were actually set in the Climate Act of 2019. So that's why this piece of legislation, I think we're seeing it come pretty early in the process. We'll be seeing other items obviously being addressed in the future to address the other goals in the Climate Act. But this piece in particular is extremely important just given the overall share of the emissions that the transportation sector represents.
Right. Wow. I didn't realize it was that high, and New York had those numbers. Now, with this bill that's going to phase out eventually gas-powered vehicles, I know there is some infrastructure now in the county and some private ones. I know the county has the government building charging station, but there's not the large infrastructure yet to handle a large amount of cars wanting to charge their vehicles. Is the county already looking at this and saying, hey, we have to sort of plan this and sort of start working on some kind of plan for buildings infrastructure to handle this new technology that's going to come on?
Well, I think that it's obviously going to be something we're going to have to take a very hard look at. And, you know, just for me, when this legislation was announced and had been signed, that was a moment where I had to step back from, you know, what we have been doing to date. So the county, the Sullivan County Government Center, we have two dual port charging stations, level two charging stations, and that's a total of four ports. We got those primarily funded through a grant. We've provided support to municipalities in the past to help them get charging stations in downtown areas, kind of as a strategy to, you know, pull people who are EV drivers into those downtowns. You know, when you charge at a level two station, it takes a couple of hours to charge. So why not, while you're charging, have a bite to eat or shop at some of our shops? That's kind of what we have done in the past. With this legislation, it flips that script completely, and it goes from being this kind of piecemeal strategy to taking a step back and realizing that we have to think about this on a much more massive and comprehensive scale than we did before. And that's going to require the engagement of a multitude of partners, not the least of which is going to be our local utilities. For Sullivan County, that would be primarily NYSEG, and then a portion would be Central Hudson and Orange and Rockland as well. Obviously, we can build as much infrastructure as we want, but if we can't bring the electricity there to actually power up those chargers, it's not going to work. So there's so many more moving parts now. We're going from, you know, needing to provide power to a very small, an extremely small portion of the vehicles that are currently on the roads, to eventually having to power all of them. And what does that look like? That's going to require a very comprehensive and coordinated approach at this point in time. And I don't think it's something that we'll be able to wait on very long, because as I said before, it's realistically only 13 years into the future. You certainly need to have the infrastructure in place before you start sending people out on the roads in zero emission vehicles. So this is going to be something that we will have to address, take a very hard look at, engage the state, engage the utilities, and also to engage all of our community partners, all of our towns and villages, our school districts, everyone's going to really have to be involved in planning on what this rollout of, you know, essentially this really new system of infrastructure is going to look like. So it's exciting and terrifying really all at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as I'm listening to you, the first thing I'm thinking about is the line of waiting to get charged. Like, you know, right now at gas stations, there's a line sometimes to wait to get gas. And you said eventually, you know, some of these stations, charging stations, take up to 2 hours to charge a car. What would that look like as far as like getting charging at home? I guess people would charge more at home than in gas stations, because I'm sure the line would be long, unless technology advances in 13 years that is fast.
Well, they do have different types of charging right now. So the easiest one for any homeowner to do, or anyone who has access to home electricity, of course, is going to be to just charge from home. And you can charge overnight. You know, level one charging will take several hours to charge your vehicle fully, but if you charge overnight while you're sleeping, then that's okay. Level two, like I said, that's going to give you, you know, a certain amount of your charge, you know, in a couple of hours. There is what's called direct current fast charging capabilities that are being pushed out with, you know, some of the larger organizations that are kind of rolling out this EV charging, as well as, you know, to a certain extent, some smaller municipalities. It's very expensive, so it's a little bit difficult for municipalities to really roll that technology out on a large scale. But that fast charging capability can charge your car in half an hour or less. The Power Authority, the New York Power Authority, is actually deploying a network of fast chargers along the New York State Thruway, as well as other major New York State roadways, including 17, Route 17 or future I-86. I'm not sure what we call it anymore these days. It's I-86 in certain places and 17 in others. But that infrastructure, ranging anywhere from a 50-kilowatt charge to a 350-kilowatt charge, can charge your vehicle in as little as 15 to 20 minutes right now. So the technology is improving, you know, and 13 years in a technological standpoint, it seems like a lifetime. You know, technology is always improving and we're getting better at what we do. But it does need to be rolled out on a larger scale. And, you know, we will certainly need, you know, the efforts of those organizations such as the New York Power Authority and obviously our local utilities to help us to build that out. So, you know, I think that it'll be very interesting to kind of see how this this evolves over time. I don't think that I can sit here and tell you this is what it's going to look like. I don't know that we, you know, that we know exactly what this is going to look like. At what point does it become economically feasible for a gas station to say, you know what, I'm going to put in my own fast charger and I'm going to charge for that, and that's going to be a moneymaker for me. It doesn't work financially right now, but when you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of vehicles on the road, that may change, you know, if you have that much larger market that you can access to recover your costs. So it'll be a very exciting time to see how this evolves. Like I said, this just happened last week, so it's still pretty new, and I think that everyone's trying to wrap their heads around it. But certainly, there is technology that is available out there right now that can charge your car much more quickly than a couple of hours. It's just a matter of, you know, the proper deployment of that infrastructure and kind of strategic locations to make sure that we're not leaving people stranded with no juice.
Right. Now, history has shown that when industry changes technology or technology changes industry, someone sort of gets left behind. Like, say, the example of the horse and carriage to the car. I'm sure people who were taking care of their horse and carriage lost business. And I'm trying to think, it might be the same thing with the gas stations, where the gas stations lose their pump stations and go full charging. And maybe people were charging more at home than they would be at the station.
Yeah, I think certainly that's going to have to be one of the considerations when the state agencies are making their considerations as far as how do they go about implementing this. They're going to have to look at those industries who are without a doubt going to be negatively impacted. You know, there's going to be opportunities for new industry, obviously, because that's typically what happens. You know, you kind of referenced, you know, with going from horses and carriage to you know, vehicles. You know, I'm sure the farrier business was probably booming in the era of the horses and carriage. And then all of a sudden came the era of the gas stations. You know, there used to be, you know, feedlots, which there still are obviously for our farmers, but I'm sure that those feedlots were probably more widespread because there were a lot more horses, a lot more need for those items. And I think that we're going to have to confront those same issues moving forward at this point in time. You know, a lot of what the Climate Act of 2019 had a huge portion of it that was dedicated to the kind of industry transition and recognizing that there's going to be industries that are going to have a more difficult time while there's going to be new industries that are going to thrive. So how do we help those industries that are, you know, having a, you know, tough time figuring out what their future might look like right now? How do we help them? You know, how do we make sure that people maybe don't get left behind, but maybe, you know, a lateral shift before we start moving forward, so to speak. And that's once again one of those items that's going to have to be addressed. The state will have to address those issues as they develop the regulations to implement this these very ambitious goals.
With all these changes, should the consumer start thinking already, my next car should be electric or should be a hybrid?
You know, I think that in the immediate term, the most important thing for people to do is to not panic and not run out the door tomorrow and, you know, say, I need to start getting on this right away. Once again, there's 13 years to the time that this will actually be, or 13 and a half, I should say, is the time this would actually be fully implemented. So in the immediate term, I think that the idea is to just not panic. I also think that this will be something that will have to come into consideration, obviously, for consumers when you're going out to purchase a vehicle in the future. But there's another layer that's coming into this whole conversation right now, because I'm sure that many of your listeners and maybe even yourself have seen advertising, you know, recently with companies like General Motors, Volkswagen. You know, they're making commitments to transition their own, you know, production to all electric anyway. So I believe that actually General Motors' commitment is by 2035, they will only be manufacturing electric vehicles. So you do have many of the large industry players from, you know, the car industry, you know, the automobile industry, that are making their own commitments right now to transferring over to all electric manufacturing, you know, of vehicles, not, you know, their operations necessarily, but the vehicles themselves that they're producing. And this is going to lead to a much wider range of options for the consumer to select from. You know, it's not going to be that if I want to get an electric vehicle, I have to get, you know, one of these 10 models over here. You're going to be able to choose a vehicle that you want to drive that does what you need it to do in your daily life that also happens to be electric. And that's going to be a very important thing for consumers to have that choice, because ultimately, you know, they have to have that choice.
I definitely agree. It's a lot of exciting things happening with charging station electric vehicles. So thank you again, Heather Brown, for talking to us, letting us know about the bill and what it means for Sullivan County and our listening area. Again, we were talking to Heather Brown, Sustainability Coordinator for Sullivan County. For Radio Catskill, I'm Patricia Robayo.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
The Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 30th, honoring our healthcare heroes for making a difference, for putting the well-being of others above all else, for staying strong in these unprecedented times, including Sullivan 180. Join us at Calicoon Hills, September 30th. Ticket information at WJFFradio.org. The Radio Catskill Community Awards, honoring our healthcare heroes, September 30th.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.
On air at 90.5 FM.
WJFFradio.org.
Listen to us on your smartphone. Download the WJFF app.
Listen to us on your smart speaker.
Like us on Facebook.
And follow us on Instagram.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected. Support for Radio Catskill comes from Sun River Health, providing accessible health care at over 40 community locations across the Hudson Valley, New York City, and Long Island. The care you need, the respect you deserve. SunRiver.org.
Okay, well, welcome back to the local edition of local news and information. It's keeping you connected in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm Jason Dole, and here in the second half of the program, well, it's National Hispanic Heritage Month, and here on the local edition this month, we're speaking to guests about issues facing Hispanic and Latino communities in our listening area. Since New York State's Excluded Workers Program opened up on August 1st, more than 165,000 people have applied. But so far, just over 91,000 have been approved. The Excluded Workers Program provides assistance for New Yorkers who lost income during the pandemic but did not qualify for earlier COVID-19 benefits. Groups like the Rural Migrant Ministry are helping to get the word out about these resources. And Juanita Sarmiento, Program Coordinator for the Rural Migrant Ministry, is here to talk with us about this program and about the Rural Migrant Ministry's upcoming 40th anniversary celebration. Juanita, hello. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. So, let's just start with that, the idea that the Rural Migrant Ministry is helping get the word out about New York's new Excluded Workers Program. What do you want people to know about it? Who's eligible and what should they do?
Absolutely. So people that are eligible is anyone who was not eligible for, workers' compensation due to pandemic work loss, or they also didn't receive a stimulus, or they were not eligible for any other type of compensation due to job loss for many different reasons, including being undocumented as well.
Okay. So if somebody falls into those categories, what do you want them to know?
So many grassroots organizations throughout New York State are offering assistance, helping people find the resources they need to be able to apply. You go to the state website for EWS, or you can Google New York State EWS, and you're able to do your application. But what we're helping with is helping people make sure that they have everything they need before they start their application, so that they don't get denied and have to reapply multiple times. So we want you to be able to have everything you need from the very beginning. Rural and Migrant Ministry does work with rural people here in areas that are far from metropolitan. I know you mentioned that over 90,000 people have applied and received support, but the majority of those people are in New York City. So one of the big issues we're seeing, is obviously access and communication about this fund, the Excluded Worker Fund. So I'm currently hiring to get people to help me go out onto the farms and the factories out here in Sullivan County. I know my coworkers in Lyons, New York, over in Western New York, they're covering a few counties over there. And I have my coworkers in Long Island and also in Cornwall doing the same thing. We're all hiring to be able to spread the word. For hiring, you do have to be documented, and it's a very small position. It's a very part-time position, but it's very flexible to your schedule. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing, is being able to get the word out, because we don't have access to people the same way that New York City has access to people. And people don't have access to us.
Yeah.
The same way that people have access to information in metropolitan areas.
Yeah, and it's easier for people to fall through the cracks in so many different ways up here, just because everybody's so spread out. And when you're talking about migrant workers, they oftentimes are living where they work, and they don't even get out of that area. So I can imagine the scale, the scope of the work you're trying to do there. Speaking of the... Well, first off, you wrapped up an overnight summer leadership camp, and that's something you've been doing for 30 years. Can you just tell, because we're running short tonight, but can you tell us quick what is a leadership camp and how did it go?
So the Summer Youth Leadership Camp is a camp that we host for rural children, children of farm workers, children of factory workers all throughout New York State. Obviously, the staff, we pick the kids up, we bring them to camp, because a lot of parents don't have access to transportation and they're working. And we take in kids from about 7-8 years old all the way up to 18. Obviously, they're split up into groups by their age. And it's an extraordinary camp, because we have professional educative artists that come to camp and work with the youth throughout the whole week of the program. It's a very affordable program. It's about $75 for the entire week. And if parents aren't able to pay the $75, they can only put $25 or $50 or whatever. We work it out. You know, our sponsors for the Overnight Leadership Camp for Rural and Migrant Ministry are very generous, and we always want to make sure that everybody can have access to this program.
This leadership camp, this is different than your Rural Women's Assembly, right? What's that?
Yes. So every year, usually the first weekend in December, we have a Rural Women's Assembly, which is gathering women from all over New York State. Again, rural women that don't have access to resources that we would like them to have access to. And this year, we're doing it during our 40th anniversary for Rural and Migrant Ministry. We are very grateful to have been around and helping the rural community for 40 years. So the Rural Women's Assembly is available, is happening that same weekend as the 40th anniversary, which is October 9th to October 10th.
So the Women's Assembly is happening as part of your 40th anniversary gala as well.
Yeah, it's going to be happening at the same time. The registration is separate because we want to make sure that we still have specific programming for the women that we normally do during our annual Rural Women's Assembly. For the 40th anniversary gala, we will be having multiple workshops, artists, grassroots leaders joining us in the celebration of all the hard work that RMM has done in the past 40 years.
And I'm looking at your website now. I see a lot of information about this at ruralmigrantministry.org. That's your website, right? Ruralmigrantministry.org.
Yes. You can also call 845-485-8627 for any info about any of the things that we spoke about today.
Okay. Let's give that phone number two more times in case anybody missed it.
Of course. So if you have any questions about the Rural Women's Assembly, the youth empowerment programs that we run, any of our other programs, the Excluded Worker Fund or the 40th anniversary, please call 845-485-8627. Again, that's 845-485-8627.
Okay, and Juanita, before we go in the last couple minutes here, you know, we've got you on here, and, you know, September 15th to October 15th is Hispanic American Cultural Heritage Month. Any thoughts on that at this time? Is that does that impact you in any way? Is there anything you want folks to know in light of that?
Yeah, I mean, this month is a celebration. It starts in the middle of September, ends in the middle of October, because of so many Independence Days that happen in Central America, starting September 15th, I'm sorry. And of course, it's super important to me. I identify as Latina. I am Colombian, through and through. I was born there and both my parents are Colombian. So being Latina, being Latinx is very important to my culture and the work I do every single day.
And, I mean, just to go back to a theme that I think kind of ran through this whole interview is, as you think of, like, the challenges that face people of color, especially Hispanic and Latino people, you're looking at whatever those challenges are. I mean, your day-to-day reality is those challenges are compounded for people living in a rural area with, like, no transportation.
Absolutely. There's lack of transportation, lack of language. Some of the workers that we work with throughout the state don't speak Spanish or English or French, so it makes it a little more difficult to be able to get them the access that they need, but we make sure that it gets done.
All right. Well, I wish you luck in the work that you do, and I want to thank you so much for talking to us tonight. And again, I'll remind folks that the website for Rural Migrant Ministries is ruralmigrantministry.org. We've been talking to Juanita Sarmiento from Rural Migrant Ministry, and I want to thank you so much for giving us this rundown. Juanita, I wish you the best.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me again. I can't wait to be on again.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Good night.
Okay, that's going to do it for the local edition, local news and information, keeping you connected in the Catskills and beyond. We'll be back tomorrow evening starting at 6:30. We'll do it all again. Remember, never miss an edition of the local edition. Look for it wherever you sign up for podcasts. The local edition from Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Public Radio.